This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll start with veteran LSU professor Kevin Cope, the longtime head of the Faculty Senate. He recently left that post, but still remains viable and visible at the Old War School, where he has toiled for 35 years in the quadrangle at Allen Hall. Kevin Cope on the controversy at the state's flagship university over changing admission standards. Also, Advocate Capital Bureau Chief Mark Ballard on the admission standards at LSU and the politics of funding LSU at the expense of other state institutions. Author Linda K. Klein is slated to be with us to discuss her book, Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women, and how she broke free. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757 in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Kevin Cope, the 35-year veteran of professorship at Louisiana State University. For more than a decade, he was head of the Faculty Senate. He recently left that post, but remains a professor of note at the Quadrangle in Allen Hall. His specialties as an English professor are 18th century literature and intellectual history, and we'll get some of that today, along with a discussion about what's going on at LSU, including the move to change the admission standards. I'm looking at your official bio, and it says that there will be a book forthcoming in 1999. I think this needs to be updated,
Dr. Pope. I knew you would catch that, Jim, but I'll tell you the nice thing about the English department is that it lives somewhat outside of history. The past, the present, they all run together. Why not with me?
Well, Mark Ballard, who will be with us later, yesterday, front page of The Advocate, had the story that a group headed by a member of the Board of Regents is blasting LSU President F. King Alexander for the university's recent decision to stop automatically disqualifying applicants who score too low on college board admissions tests like the ACT. We must stop King Alexander from lowering standards at LSU, this group called Put Louisiana First states on its Facebook page. What do you make of this?
This is one case, Jim, where I think I'm going to have to disappoint you and say that this is something of a tempest in a teapot. That is, I do not think that the ACT or the SAT or any of the other parts of the alphabet soup by which students are evaluated constitute the only means by which you can measure a student. Now, I want to walk that back just a little bit. We know from our president that walking back is trendy, so I want to do the same and point out that it is important to make these kinds of measures. But it's also important to understand that the ACT and the SAT have been called into question many times by able scholars and that they're driven by fashion. And then on top of that, the companies that operate them, or foundations as they prefer to call themselves, are big business, and they're trying to protect their territory too.
Well, producer Matt Doyle has a piece of tape ready from Richard Lipsey, member of the Board of Regents, who's not at all happy about this prospect of change. Here's Richard Lipsey, of course, fascinating gentleman, has been with us on various topics. He was the bodyguard to one John Fitzgerald Kennedy many moons ago. Here's Richard Lipsey.
Lady of the Lake College, I think it's Our Lady University now. They used to have the same standards to enroll their students. Then they dropped it and went the holistic approach. And all at once, their retention went down, their graduation rate went down, and boom, they turned it around and went back to the higher admission standards. Lowering our admission standards is also going to hurt, as I told you before, it's going to hurt our regional colleges, our ULM and Nichols and McNeese, because that's the heart of Louisiana supporting these other colleges. And if now we can say, well, you know, don't worry about supporting Thibodeau or Lake Charles. You can come to LSU because we're going to lower our standard, and all we're doing is hurting the colleges and the cities around the state. So
that's Richard Lipsey, your response, Dr.
Okay, I've got a couple of observations here. First of all, we've always had holistic admission standards in the sense that if you could push the ball through that hole known as the basket or the goalpost, you could qualify for one of the 5% exceptions that the university accords. So that's a holistic in the most literal sense. Next of all, it's curious to hear Mr. Lipsey talking about running down the regional colleges because, among other things, what the decision makers in this state have done over the years is induce a competition among colleges. You can drive up and down Interstate 10 and see billboards put up by one university trying to get students from another university to go elsewhere. So it would seem to me that, first of all, the regents need to clean up their act and decide whether they want competition or not. And third of all, as I said just a minute ago, this is not the only measure of student qualification. We should not lower standards. I agree with Mr. Lipsey about that, but we need to figure out what the standards are.
877-217-5757 is your number. Anne Marie at LSU. I think Anne Marie's a professor. Good morning to you. You're on the air on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Kevin Cope. Hi, Anne Marie.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to weigh in very briefly on the holistic admissions. I'm a faculty member in the College of Music and Dramatic Art. And very often we see students who are extremely gifted in one of the visual or performing arts who nevertheless aren't a great test taker or perhaps don't excel in the standardized tests. So I welcome the opportunity to look at the whole child who applies. I want to see what they did in high school. I want to read their letters of recommendation. I want to hear them play, sing, do their art. And one of the things that makes it an LSU a great place to work is that we have such a broad variety of majors. Not every major needs to have the identical set of standards and criteria for admission. And I really like the word holistic, and I think it's completely appropriate.
Thank you, Anne Marie. Your thoughts, Dr. Cope?
Sure. Among other things, what Anne-Marie points out is the paradox of what we nowadays call a comprehensive university. That's an official technical education term for an institution that covers most, if not all, of the fields in which one can do inquiry or get qualifications. And there, of course, you have to have students who are able to get through the general education curriculum. They have to meet certain minimum qualifications. But what Anne-Marie says is exactly right. That is, the reality, no matter what the concept might tell us, the reality is that once students get past a certain point, they tend already, even in their young years, to start specializing, and the qualifications to be a virtuoso on the tuba are probably rather different from those required to detect gravitational waves or, heaven forbid, go into my field of work, which is the study of the 18th century, which everybody has probably rightfully forgotten.
877-217-5757 is your number for Dr. Kevin Cope. 35 years at the Old War School, and it's good to hear from another professor, Anne Marie. And we go to Lafayette. Chuck, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Chuck.
Good morning. I agree with Dr. Cope and your previous speaker. I'd just like to point out that a lot of students take the standardized test multiple times, and there are preparation courses for those. So I don't know that the scores on those mean as much as they used to. I would also point out that I believe UL is eliminating their GRE requirement for graduate school and looking at other components more heavily. Thank you.
All right, Chuck.
Got an excellent point there. It might even be argued that these tests, ACT and SAT, have become instruments of social injustice because you can drive up and down the area around LSU or even further afield, and you can see exam preparation school after exam preparation school, all of them taking in big dollars in order to hype students up to get through this particular test. So that means that those who have got money are going to do a little bit better and perhaps even qualify to go into the elite universities. That having been said, I've got to stress again that we've got to come up with some other kind of test or qualifications or measures because we will have total chaos if we just admit everybody. That was the case back in the 1980s when I started, and that produced one heck of a lot of student tickets at the football stadium.
We have an op-ed piece from King Alexander, the president and chancellor at LSU and today's advocate, and he says, we've increased our class size without sacrificing quality or academic rigor. This class has a preliminary mean GPA of 3.5, holding steady from last year. The class has a mean ACT score of 26, also holding steady, he writes. In fact, as of today, 18% of this class has scored 30 or above on the ACT, another university record. That from King Alexander, who touts those numbers as being very good. And LSU is measured quite often in these national rankings by U.S. News and World Report and others based on factors like ACT scores. Is that fair?
Here we got another paradox. King Alexander is constantly talking about how much he hates the rankings and wants to replace them with another R-word, ratings, or something else. And yet, when this sort of situation arises, out come the rankings. I am glad that King Alexander is talking about the merit of people at LSU, because we need certainly to hear more of that, and he's doing the right thing there. I wish that he would find some other way to do this than the cold metrics that he loves to deploy. So we talk about the mean accomplishment. Well, what does that exactly mean, to use the word in another sense? If you're at the top of the spectrum, well, the mean doesn't mean anything. If you're at the bottom, you're not at the mean. Who isn't at the mean? Nevertheless, the basic point there, that is, that the class overall has qualifications, is a sound one, and I compliment the president for it, although I urge him to think a little more broadly.
He writes also, Dr. Cope, that 80% of flagship universities are using this so-called holistic approach, as he says, all but two of the nation's top 50 public universities. Schools like Chapel Hill, Austin, UCLA, University of Virginia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Berkeley, all of those are cited by King Alexander, and people are resistant to change. It's an amazing phenomenon. Even if it's good change, people are resistant to it. I think he's a very smart man. I'm sure President Alexander knew this was coming.
I have no doubt that he saw it in the crystal ball which hovers over the university administration building. However, there again, I would point out that the resistance to change is even embedded in the message that King Alexander is sending. Again, I'm glad he's sending the right one, but why are we comparing ourselves to 80%? Shouldn't we be in the top 20%?
There you go. We'll hear more from the fired up Dr. Kevin Cope, 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana, Matt Doyle producing, and a bit more time with Kevin Cope, 35-year veteran of the Old War School, master's degree from Harvard University, PhD from Harvard University, grew up in San Diego and got his bachelor's degree from Pitzer College, which is not as noted as Harvard.
Not as noted, but at least I was on the upward trajectory. I wasn't running downhill.
And then you came to LSU and probably thought, I'll be here a year or two, and you've been here ever since.
Lo and behold, time has dilated.
Well, this move to change the admission standards, touted by the president of the university, has met fire from people like Richard Lipsey, who's on the Board of Regents, an erudite man about town, a Baton Rougean of note. And Dr. Cope seems to have an open mind, and actually, in this case, he sometimes differs with the president, but he has indicated he's open to this holistic view of a student. Mike Hawkins writes, could you ask Dr. Cope if it's true that the College of Humanities and Social Sciences has implemented a policy that considers the numbers of D's and F's a faculty member confers when evaluating the faculty member for promotion and tenure?
Thank you, Mike. And Mike, by the way, is one of our most distinguished and long-serving faculty members at LSU. I would like to say that that policy has not been implemented. Of course, there is talk about it, but at the universities, talk about everything. Far more serious, though, is the fact that the university as a whole monitors the so-called DFW rate. That's not Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. That's D's, F's, and withdrawals. And, of course, is concerned about the relation between that DFW rate and the amount of tuition coming in the door. And this brings us back around in a big circle to the Lipsey tape that you played a minute ago, because, again, the regents have not decided whether they want to use universities as sort of a glorified training ground for the workhouse, that is, to create an inexpensive labor force, or whether they really want to pursue an educational policy that would lead people to make inquiries, maybe turn dissenter, and otherwise become educated persons.
877-217-5757. There is still time to talk with Dr. Kevin Cope and perhaps agree or disagree or offer some insights we have not heard. Mike in Sherwood Forest. Hi, Mike. You're on with Dr. Cope.
Hi. I had two quick points. First, a lot of folks come out of high school and aren't sure what they're doing and get to college and maybe get inspired. So If they don't do well in their grades in high school or on their SATs or ACTs, it seems to me that a holistic approach would be good. Second, expanding on the idea that the good doctor stated about, I guess, roadblocks to higher education, can you address the abysmal cuts to primary, secondary, preschool and college level education, because we're looking at a baby in the bathwater problem.
That is an excellent question, because one of the things that's happened in Louisiana in the government is that the various wings of the education effort have been pitted against one another. So we're competing in the universities for funding against K through 12. That's not the official line, but that's what's really happening. And this, in turn, induces an atmosphere of non-cooperation. One of the things we really need to do is shore up K through 12 and also pre-K education so that we don't end up expanding the universities into that line of work. When I started here, of course, we had a big remedial project going. We don't do that anymore, at least not officially, but this is really a kind of compensation for the inadequacies of K through 12, and that's not the fault of K through 12. That's the fault of the people who fund it.
Stephanie Regal in the Business Report, the current one, writes, perhaps it's time to rethink TOPS and move toward a needs-based system. If public money is going to cover tuition so parents can cover their daughters' dorm windows and in nice drapes, there's something wrong. That's from Stephanie, who informs me that she was first on this story about the changing or possible changing of admission standards. What do you think about TOPS? Where are we going with TOPS?
Yeah, I'm going to hit that at two angles. First of all, she's right that it is already a de facto needs-based program. That is, the requirements are dressed up to make sure that all of the needs are covered. And second of all, as you know, Jim, from my past appearances here, I am opposed to financing universities through tuition. What this does is create a giant bureaucracy by which the government gives money to TOPS, TOPS gives it to students, students give it back to the universities, and the universities turn around and pay it back to the state in terms of fees. If we simply had a block grant to the universities and allowed them to submit it to set admissions requirements and indeed have a certain number of students rather than constantly trying to expand, we would not have this tremendous waste.
And J.R. Ball, Stephanie's colleague at the Business Report, writes in the same issue that tuition for a full-time in-state student taking 15 hours per semester at LSU is $8,047 this academic year. J.R. writes that roughly it's only 27% of the 30,360 LSU says it will take to attend the old war school. In other words, there's $22,314 worth of other expenses that have zero to do with TOPS. So he concludes, J.R. does, that students are still in debt even with TOPS.
No question about that. When you consider what the average median income, the median income is in Louisiana, the number of children that most families have, you can see that the numbers just don't add up. So what we have done is, again, create a tremendous social welfare program disguised as a merit-based program, when in fact what we really need to do is cut out a lot of the bureaucracies concerned with that.
Do you recall what you paid when you went to school?
I didn't pay anything. The state of California covered everything.
Well, when you went to Harvard?
When I went to Harvard, I was theoretically paying around $20,000 a year. That was in between 1978 and 83. But there again, I was subsidized because I had a fellowship and government grants and everything else.
When I enrolled at LSU in the fall of 77 the first time, I still remember my fee bill. And I was an out-of-state student. I was on the meal plan. I was in a dorm. I had insurance. I had to pay for a parking spot and books and everything. First semester, $1,098.
There we've got another victory for the out-of-state. We hear a lot of these regions talking about keeping our kids in-state or educating the kids that are in-state. Here is one of Louisiana's most roaring successes, Jim Inkster, harvested from someplace over the border, beyond Trump's wall.
Well, in Alabama, they honor Mississippi students as in-state students and vice versa because they're trying to stimulate enrollment, I suppose. Should we do something like that here?
Yeah, a lot of states play that funny game. And indeed, some years ago, we even did that with Texas, I think it was. We declared a certain range, 20, 30 miles of Texas, to be a kind of no man's land or demilitarized zone that sort of belonged to us, too.
And as we look at the situation at LSU, we're often compared, as you know, unfavorably with Alabama when it comes to football. And now a listener notes that Alabama is sending all kinds of recruitment letters and making these robust offers to some of the finest students in Louisiana and snaring them away from the Bayou State.
Well, that's right. I wish that perhaps they'd go a little bit further afield in Alabama, because I believe that students benefit when they go completely out of their region. That's the other way, too. I'd like to see some students from far away Idaho or Minneapolis or wherever else coming down here. But yes, that is true. All of those universities that are on the make have instituted big discount rates and have found a way to grab students from Louisiana and elsewhere, I might say.
Angus, great name, writes, and I knew this one was coming, why is the Faculty Senate continuing to censure the fine president of LSU, King Alexander?
That's right. That censure remains in force. That originates with a couple of problems. Chief among them is the situation that arose a few years with a professor who was dismissed in contradiction to the recommendation of the...
This is Ms. Buchanan or Dr. Buchanan.
That's correct. I leave it to you to use real names. You've got liability insurance. I don't. But I want to affirm that that is the cause of the censure. There are also some other censures out there. That is, LSU is under censure from the American Association of University Professors for academic freedom violations, as are four or five other Louisiana schools.
Well, Angus writes that the president is no longer attending faculty Senate meetings, and can you blame him?
Well,
if he's under censure by your fine group.
Actually, the president, as I understand it, I had to miss that one, did go to the last faculty Senate meeting. But, of course, that just demonstrates that we do not have a culture of public engagement. That is, it is my opinion that public officials, when they are subjected to criticism, ought to go out into the town hall and talk about it and, indeed, take measures to resolve the problem.
And this professor, as we go to the break, she was basically thrown out for using naughty words in class, right? Like the F word?
Yeah, the same words that I hear in academic administration halls day in and day out.
Do you hear them on the football field?
Yeah, I sure do.
We'll be back. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We're about to join Mark Ballard, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Advocate, who has been writing fervently about this possible change in admission standards at LSU. We're closing it out with Kevin Cope, the 35-year veteran of the faculty at LSU, and for more than a decade, he was the leader of the Faculty Senate. And once again, your number is 877-217-5757, and email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Quickly, before we dispense with you, Dr. Cope, Kiana wants to know if you were forced out as a head of the faculty senate.
No, certainly not. I received a sabbatical leave. I'd been in office 10 years and 2 years before that, and maybe I didn't go out a winner, but at least, as Les Miles used to say, I went out with my head held high.
There you go, and you're still at LSU. And as far as this controversy, which is still present, obviously, over the firing of Teresa Buchanan for using inappropriate words in the classroom, does the same standard apply to the football coach, to the basketball coach, other athletic leaders who might have one of those words slip every now and then?
I haven't been down there with my hidden voice recorder, but I would be astonished if that didn't happen on the football field and among the blessed fans day in and day out.
Well, I remember Les Miles at a Bayou Bash event several years ago actually referring to Alabama and using the F word in the same sentence.
Well, you have to trace the grammar there, I suppose.
But why wasn't he fired?
That is an extremely good question, and I think we need to recruit you into the Faculty Senate. Maybe you've got a censure up your sleeve.
No, I really think that it would be better for the university, which is my alma mater, if the president, who by and large I think has done a credible job, if he were not under censure by the faculty. So when do you say enough is enough?
Well, the censure has been passed in response to a state of affairs. When the president resolves the state of affairs, the censure will go away. Simple as that. It's not the fault. The argument you're putting forth is to suggest that it's the court that's guilty for the criminal.
Well, I don't think he's a criminal, is he?
No, I'm just making an analogy. So it is the responsibility of the person who has perpetrated the error to rectify it.
Well, this is analogous to somebody writing an anonymous editorial to the New York Times who's working for the president and not revealing who they are, and there's mutiny in the ranks.
No, there's no anonymity at
all. I know.
Everybody on the Swagley Senate is on the record.
Your vote is recorded.
That's right.
That's a good correction. And as usual, you correct me a time or two, and we thank you for doing so.
Thank you,
Dr. Kevin Cope.
Enjoyed it.
A pleasure.
Great.
And Mark Ballard, who's been reporting about this controversy, if you will, at LSU, is with us, the Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. And Mark, as we noted with Dr. Cope, people are often resistant to anything new, and the president of LSU makes a point that this is being done in many other places at high-quality institutions. Why is it such a source of anguish at LSU?
That's been something that I've been wondering about myself, but I always come back to we in Louisiana don't really like our first reaction to a lot of things is we've never done it that way before. And this might be one of them. I don't know.
It seems that it's probably much ado about very little. I wouldn't say nothing, but this is not going to shake the earth at LSU, is it?
I don't think so. I mean, almost every other major university in the country is doing this particular holistic admissions standards. Now, we're a little bit different in that, and Mr. Lipsey is right about this, is that one is that we were an open admissions school back when you and I were going there. We didn't need ACT scores, and thank God for that, or I would never have gotten to LSU.
We still had to take the ACT, though, I think. I know I took it.
Well, I think I got my name correct on it, but that was about it. So I was solo. But the thing is that it was for decades. It was an open admissions university, and then they were trying to too many people flunked out, and they were trying to come up with a different way of getting the students in, and that was a terrible fight when, if you'll recall, back in the 80s and early 90s, of trying to get these ACT courses, the tests, minimums involved. Mm-hmm. And now we're switching back to where they are still important, but not the only thing that's being looked at.
Well, I took the test more than 40 years ago, but I recall when I took it, I knew going in that unlike other tests, you're not penalized for wrong answers. So in one of the sections, I remember I ran out of time. I had like the two-minute warning, and I had like 15 questions, so I just put in like, you know, C, D, B, A, and I don't know if I got those right or wrong, but It's a test where 36 is the maximum score. Really, you should be able to get a 9 just by filling in the blanks statistically.
Yes, yeah, and I mean the running joke is that it if you can spell your name correctly throughout the test, then I think you get like a 15 or a 16 right there. So by the way, all those expensive ACT prep courses that a lot of parents are paying for. Their recommendation when you get towards the end of the test is to do just what you did, and that is just kind of guess at it. You have a 1 in 4 chance of getting it right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark Ballard went to LSU and to Columbia University, one of the great institutions in the world. Like Kevin Cope, who was a Harvard graduate, you have an Ivy League background. As far as the quality of instruction, was there a big gap, or was it similar, or what do you think about this perception that you don't get a fully comparable education unless you go to a school like Columbia or Harvard?
Well, I don't think that that's totally correct. Yes, there was a marked difference between the instruction at Columbia than the instruction at LSU. However, I would never have made it to Columbia without LSU. I mean that's just a fact. And I think that LSU, even back in the day, and it's far better than it was when you and I went to school there, provided a good enough instruction to kind of, you know, to allow you to step up your game. And I think that's the best that we can have. I mean, not everybody is going to be making 35s and 36s on, you know, and getting straight A's on STEM courses and that sort of thing.
But I saw, like, at Baton Rouge High, there was a story in your paper not so long ago. I think 12 of the students there scored perfect scores on the ACT. Perfect scores. Actually, I'm informed that some of them did not score perfect, but it was rounded to a 36. But there were some who did score, got every question right. To me, that's almost unimaginable.
Well, it is to me, too. I don't think even today I could get a perfect score, or even in the 30s on the ACT.
So, you've had children who've taken that test, though.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And they've done pretty well on it. But then on the other hand is that, you know, they go to, good quality schools. We spent money on ACT preparation. It took them to museums and took them on trips. They've, been overseas. And that is not the case for the vast majority of students in the state of Louisiana. And that is one of the issues that have come up with about these standardized College Board tests, is that they're kind of more aimed for my kids than they are for a child who grew up in poverty, who grew up in a family that did not have college-educated parents, and who have learning disabilities. I mean, it's a long list, and that is, to being the only metrics in deciding which school you're going to, is that is what the problem is. That's the issue that's being raised about these standardized tests.
Now, Mark Ballard, you follow the Capitol, and down at the Capitol, quite often LSU is fighting for money, and something some may not appreciate is that many of these lawmakers in other parts of the state, they're not all that warm and fuzzy about LSU, and it really is a tough sell. In some cases, they resent the flagship University of Louisiana. How does LSU fight that pushback?
Well, yeah, I don't want to be, rude about it, but they are kind of, we're the flagship and you're not, kind of is the way that they approach that sort of thing. And I saw that when, in reporting this story, and when I did it on Sunday, was that I talked to leaders of the other universities, and the ones that would actually talk about it basically came up with what, Dr. Henderson of the UL system said, and that is, first off, you're wrong in starting off with the assumption that everybody wants to go to LSU, that a lot of these statewide and regional colleges offer programs and a campus lifestyle that appeals to a lot of students. And so I think that right there kind of gives an indication of how the regents, how the legislatures looks at LSU, and that is, you're the flagship, and then their response to it is a lot like the vice president, Jason Drotti, said, saying, are we trying to cherry pick the best and the brightest in the state of Louisiana? Yeah, and we're going to keep on doing it. So there,
Yeah. Well, LSU is the big kid on the block in Louisiana, and some lawmakers are representing universities in their districts that may not appreciate that. And Mark, as we finish up, it appears, based on historical context, that LSU usually fares better when a governor is in office who attended Louisiana State University. And I've seen it with the two governors, Edwards and Governor Foster. It seems to make a difference.
I've never really looked at it that closely before. I know that Governor Jindal made a lot of changes on the LSU Board of Supervisors and in the hierarchy at LSU. In fact, he was the one that brought in King Alexander, and so I think you might be correct. He did a lot more. Governor Jindal did a lot more at changes to the flagship than
and a lot of budget cuts, of course. To
massive
LSU.
Budget cuts.
Massive budget cuts. Well, Mark Ballard, it is always a pleasure. Let's talk again next week, and we'll let you get back to work at the Capitol. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll return after this pause with fascinating author Linda K. Klein. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We switch gears, and we're joined by Linda K. Klein. She's the founder of Break Free Together. has spent over a decade working at the intersection of faith, gender, sexuality, and social change. She earned her master's degree from NYU, focusing on American evangelical Christian gender and sexuality messaging for girls. And her book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. Hi, being Linda K. Klein. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And some of our listeners are probably vaguely familiar with this purity movement, purity culture inside the evangelical movement. Can you tell us what your perception is?
Absolutely. Purity culture has a lot of different components, but the one that I'm the most interested in is that girls and women are taught that there are really only two categories that they can fit into, pure and impure. And you are really, your purity is orchestrated or is determined by the community. So you can become less pure in people's eyes based on your own sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors, but also on the sexual thoughts and behaviors of men in the community toward you that you are seen to have inspired by the way that you dressed or by the way that you walked or talked.
How did this affect you?
It created a tremendous amount of anxiety. You know, there were all kinds of different definitions about what was pure and what was impure. Some people felt that if you even had an emotional relationship with someone of the opposite sex that was too intimate, that you were risking losing your purity, whereas other people felt that as long as you waited to have sex until marriage, you were pure. So with all of these various definitions of purity, you were in a constant state of wondering what you might do, what sexual thought or feeling or choice or thought or feeling or choice that you might inspire in someone else would have you suddenly fall from the purity grace.
Why are we still so hung up on sexual activity?
What a great question. I mean, you know, I can't tell you exactly why this is a focus within the community. I think it goes back pretty far. You know, we have Greco-Roman culture where Aristotle and Plato were talking about the idea that the intellect was much more important and valuable than the earthly plane. So we've had a mind-body disconnection for a very long time in our culture, and that was really something that early Christian, influential leaders really took quite seriously and borrowed from this Greco-Roman culture that is therefore just deeply embedded within our functioning as a faith and as a culture. And in evangelical Christianity in particular, it really has been taken on as a primary focus.
Well, you write about the prominence of what you view as shame in our country's religious and societal sexual ethics. How does this affect the society as a whole?
Yeah, when I say shame, I'm not talking about bashfulness. I'm not talking about shyness. I'm talking about the researcher's definition of shame. You know, shame is this feeling I am something bad, or people will think that I am something bad, as opposed to, say, guilt, which is this feeling I did something bad. So feeling that you are something bad, this is no small thing. It's associated with feelings of worthlessness, desperation, hopelessness. It really can create a tremendous amount of anxiety, shame, and fear that I found doesn't go away. You know, we really teach girls to experience these things in association with our sexuality and our sexual bodies when they're quite young. And as we become older, it's still there. And among many of the women who I've spoken with, and I experienced this myself as well, sometimes this fear and shame and anxiety manifests in ways that actually mimic classic PTSD symptoms.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. People are having nightmares. People are having physical reactions to sexuality, sometimes even to walking into a church. Those physical reactions can sometimes become so extreme that people are having panic attacks and are, you know, going to the hospital for panic attacks. People are sometimes walking in so much anxiety about being considered, impure or impure based on their community's definition that they become almost paranoid. You know, they fear that they are being watched And sometimes they are, because, you know, certainly anyone who grew up in a purity culture, whether that purity culture was your religious culture or your family, or really just society, we know that people are, mm-hmm. are watching you and waiting for you to make a sexual misstep.
The book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free, from our guest Linda K. Klein. 877-217-5757 is your number, and talk@talklouisiana.org. A question from Holly asking about these abstinence-only provisions, and sometimes in Louisiana we had a program of that kind. Do you believe those are good things or bad?
So the research shows that abstinence-only education actually does not meaningfully delay the number or the time that somebody has their first sexual experience, and doesn't meaningfully reduce the number of sexual partners that someone has overall. So they're incredibly ineffective in their intended purpose of keeping people from having sex. However, there's new research right now that's being done that's finding that abstinence-only messaging, particularly in religious communities where people, you know, have a really strong identification with the messaging, does do something really well, and that something that it does really well is it creates shame.
Another listener asks about, this from Tracy, the condemnation of President Clinton for sexual misconduct, and yet the religious right has embraced President Trump despite the activities involving the president and a Playboy playmate and a pornographic film star. Is there a disconnect there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an important question. Many people in the evangelical community, you know, that I grew up in are baffled, are baffled by this ourselves, right? You know, we spoke so much about purity when I was growing up in the community, and it was such an important thing. Many of us felt that it was the most important way that we could express our Christian identity, our Christian faith. And so I think a lot of people who are in the community are rather stumped by this as well.
Now, you definitely take aim at the evangelical movement, but are there examples of churches that you view as healthier models of promotion of sexuality?
Absolutely. In fact, I even find that there are some evangelical churches that are healthy. Unfortunately, they're not as frequent or as frequently found as I would like for them to be, but, you know, they're out there. And I feature a couple of them in my book as models for evangelical churches that are talking about sexuality in a really helpful way. But I really look to the United Church of Christ often, and they co-created a really important sexuality education curriculum with the Unitarian Universalist Association called Our Whole Lives, or OWL. And it's a lifespan sexuality education curriculum. So they actually start talking with you know, people as young as kindergarten about healthy relationships, how you expect to be treated, how you should be treating others. And then the curriculum goes on, and eventually, you know, they actually are working on right now one for people who are retirement age, and really see this as something that, you know, as you get to the developmentally appropriate stage, you start to talk about sexuality, and as you grow older, you talk about it a little bit differently. So I find that to be a really inspiring model.
You cite, Linda Kay, a connection between what you view as the purity culture and rape culture. How do those come together in your view?
Yeah. So unfortunately, you know, when we set a precedent of blaming girls and women for the sexual thoughts and feelings and actions of others, you know, we are feeding into rape culture. So when I was growing up, I was very often pulled aside and talked to about the way that I walked or talked or dressed. You know, and told, you are a stumbling block for the boys and men in our community. You know, they will trip over you on their pathway to God. And really, it's your responsibility to look out for the men and boys who are so easily sexually tempted. It's your responsibility to maintain their purity. And ultimately what that does is it sets us up later, when there is violence, to say, well, you know, the girl and the woman is responsible for maintaining her sexual purity. So what did she do wrong that allowed for this violence to happen? What was she wearing? Was she drinking? Was she, you know, out too late and we think she should have been in bed by this hour? You know, whatever the case might be, we are trained to go to the girl and the woman as the person to blame.
We have about a minute left, but what was the catalyst that broke you free?
Yeah, so much of this has been about storytelling for me. I spent the last 12 years interviewing people who were raised in religious communities like my own, and in those years, I told my story over and over and over again, and I heard them tell me stories that were really mirroring my own. You know, the details were different, but that sexual shame and fear and anxiety was the same. And that experience of doing that story exchange and realizing that I wasn't alone. And if I wasn't alone, that meant that the problem couldn't be me. The problem was what we were taught. That was the beginning of my being able to break free. And that's one of the reasons that I'm actually now, through the organization Break Free Together, encouraging people to tell their stories and to come into community where we can begin to heal together. And one of the ways that we're doing that is we're putting out a hashtag called Break Free Together so people can share their stories online and then find one another.
Well, the book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free, from Linda K. Klein. Gloria Steinem says, Linda K. takes us inside religious purity culture as only one who grew up in it can. And we thank you for your time today and congratulations on your book, Linda K. Klein. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.